Machete Mate recognizes the traditional owners of the land on which we are recording. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and any indigenous elders of other communities who may be listening today. We stand in solidarity in their struggle towards the colonization and land back. Buenas, mi gente. What is good? This is Machete Mate. Current events today. I love doing the current events because we get to talk about the whole region and sort of linking the struggles and all that bullshit, right? But how dope have our interviews been, right? I've enjoyed them and we've gotten some good feedback about them, so we're going to keep fucking doing them. On that note, this past week we sat down with friend of the show and dear comrade Blanca Esteves for a comrade convo that blew us the fuck away. It was incredible. Mm-hmm. It was the day after the El Salvador legislative elections. Results were still coming in, but the writing was on the wall, right? And it wasn't good. It wasn't good, to say the least. But she took us on a journey of how her family left El Salvador because of the Civil War and settled in Arkansas, of all places. How she struggled to navigate her identity as a brown woman, as a salvadoreña, as a Latina woman, in what was essentially a sundown town in the South, right? How she got into politics with the Democrat Party and how she quickly became disillusioned, to put it lightly. And how she ended up on the DSA MPC and her vision for El Salvador and how we're going to win and how we move towards internationalism, right? Because that's what we're about here in Machete Mate, building a truly international movement towards socialism, especially in the global South. It was dope as shit. So please check it out if you haven't already. Austin was also featured on Left Reckoning and offered a laser focused like sermon on Puerto Rico and a bit on Ecuador. Bro, like I was telling you off camera just before, like you were in the fucking zone. Like usually on your game, but this shit was just like, and it was inspiring to watch, my friend. It was inspiring to watch. So definitely check that out because I think it's still up on their page. So at Left Reckoning, definitely check that out. Anyway, quick shout out to our new compas oficiales, Danny, Eli, our OG Boricua homegrown comrade Eva, love you, Kenneth, Alex, and Blanca herself. Gracias por solidar, compas. Yeah, hell yeah. So yeah, thanks for the solidarity. If you dig what we do and want to help us on our mission to bring awareness to the struggle in America, please consider showing your solidarity on our Patreon. You'll also gain access to Machete After Dark, where we have some special bonus content. We're a little less political. It's definitely going to be political because that's what we're about. But definitely, we have a lot of fun doing that, and we try to be silly on that. Otherwise, follow us on Twitter, IG, and TikTok. Anyway, I'm Leroy from so-called Australia, and we got the homies T.
What's up, y'all? How's it going?
And of course, the man Austin.
Hello, hello. Happy to be here. And also, just wanted to quickly plug that I was also on another podcast this week, in addition to Left Reckoning. That was Meet the Left with Kenzo Shibata, which I also thoroughly enjoyed and also recommend people to check out.
Definitely. That was really good as well. Anyway, before we actually get into it, quick check-in. How we doing, boys? How we feeling? What's up? What's good? What's new? T, take it away.
I mean, I'm all right. I'm still getting settled because, you know, I recently moved a few days ago. So I'm still trying to get settled. It kind of hard to because I'm still a working class, fucker. So I have to still work. So I'm basically waiting for my next day off to actually unpack my shit. So I'm still just trying to get settled and get my bearings around my new spot. Yeah.
That's dope. But finding it okay? Everything pretty chill? Like settling in?
Oh, yeah. Everything's chill. Yeah. Definitely. Definitely. I'm glad to be here, honestly. It's an undisclosed location. I just figure I keep that quiet nowadays.
Yeah. Seriously. It's completely off the grid. Absolutely. Austin,
Yep. No one knows where. What about you, Austin?
Yeah, no, definitely it's been a hell of a week, I must say. I helped you move, so that was a thing right. That I did this week. In addition to, I think this is my fourth podcast of what is going to be a row of five after I do an appearance on Midwest Socialist tomorrow night. So it's definitely been quite a week. I'm feeling good, though. I'm feeling excited about the stories we're going to cover, and I'm feeling excited about all the work that we are doing right now. How about you, Leroy? How are you feeling?
Nah, no real complaints, to be honest. I had that week off, not this past week, the week before for my birthday. So then I had the week back at work, which is, it's always a fucking struggle trying to like, it's like to use your terminology, T, it's like whiplash. You know what I mean? You're so chill, you're so relaxed and straight back into it. You know what I mean? But look, no real complaints because I have a 3-day weekend. Tomorrow's Labor Day here, actually. So I have the weekend off and I have tomorrow off as well. So yeah, looking forward to that. What else? My brother just moved to New York yesterday, moved to Brooklyn. Nice. And what's really funny because, because a few years ago he had gotten to NYU, spent like a semester there before feeling homesick, so moved back to Florida. But like when he moved back to Florida, something clicked and was like, nah, look, the opportunities that I'm after are back up there. So ever since he's been, you know, grinding to save up money to move back to New York. And he finally did it. And it's funny because like, obviously I live in Australia. I've been here for like 10, 11 years. But like, I felt really sad. Like it felt like he was leaving home and I was like dismissing him and taking, you know what I mean? Like, even though I've been over here, but I've reached out to some folks that I know that in the area, I'm like, you're just, you know, if you can just check up on him and stuff, look after him. And they're really cool about it. So, much love to my little brother, who's actually a, you know, patron of the show, and, love you, little dude. Yeah. Austin, you're going to say something?
Yo, yeah, Leroy, you were talking about, you know, how you've, you know, you seen your brother leave home and stuff like that. Yo, I've said this a million times. I'm going to say it again. One day, we're going to get you to do your life story episode. We're going to do it. We're going to do the Leroy Conrad conversation. We're going to talk about why the hell you're in Australia. Bro, tell me how I saw you tweeting today nonchalantly like, oh, yeah, when I was in Ireland doing whatever. Bro, why the fuck were you in Ireland?
Muffin I need sons, to know
this story as well. Bro, exactly. I need – how the fuck – bro, you're an interesting – we're going to have the Leroy Conrad conversation, mark my words. I don't know when, but we're going to have it and it's going to happen at some point.
All right. Sounds good. But that'll be down the road. We'll do the business now. Anyway, moving on. So the few headlines and we'll get into it. So first headline that when I read this blew me the fuck away because it's nothing new, nothing surprising, but just it's one of those things that just reading it just fucking irked me. So in Peru, thousands of women in Peru have taken to the streets demanding justice for having been forcibly sterilized during the Fujimori tenure. Some 272,028 people were sterilized between 1996 to 2001. Most, of course, were poor indigenous women and many without consent. Like, that's not surprising. Like, we know that shit's going down. And it was all done as part of his family planning policy, right? Which purported to give women, quote, the tools necessary for them to make decisions about their lives. But in fact, as revealed in government documents published by the Peru Human Rights Ombudsman's Office in 2002, the regime saw controlling birth rates as a way to fight, quote, resource depletion, end quote, economic downturn. This was just fucking eugenics, just a continuation of colonial notions of the, quote, Indian problem, and an idea that these subhuman brown people are more fertile than whites and will go on one day to replace them, right? It's that fucking great replacement theory. It's the same shit the U.S. did to Puerto Rican women for decades. It's the same shit that's happening right now at the hands of the U.S. Against asylum seekers. We're abolitionists here. But I hope Fujimori fucking rots in his fucking cell because he's in fucking prison. And I hope his fucking daughter Kiko never gets anywhere near wielding any sort of power. Because if you think Alberto Fujimori was a fucking fascist dickhead, his daughter on a different fucking level. What the fuck do you guys think about that shit?
So, I think it bears repeating that this is a great example of a trend, a crime, an atrocity that we see over and over and over again. This is not the first time or the first place in the Americas where poor women, especially indigenous women, black women, are forcibly sterilized against their will. Something that bears repeating is that misogyny and patriarchy, in some respects, I think you could argue, is like the oldest form of reactionary politics. So, yep. You know, anytime, you know, reactionaries are obsessed with controlling women and especially women's, you know, they want to take away a woman's bodily autonomy, you know, or any, yeah. You know, anybody who, you know, anybody with a uterus, they want to take away their autonomy, right? And part of that is taking away the ability to have kids, right? Not only do they want to take away the right of people to end a pregnancy, they also want to take their ability to have a pregnancy away from them. The common root of all of this, of both the anti-abortion stuff and also the sterilizations, what brings that stuff together beyond just the white supremacy and the, you know, the whitening effect is, which, as you point out, a similar phenomenon we saw in Puerto Rico, is the fact that it is about controlling women and specifically women, you know, women's bodies, you know?
Yeah. And if I'm not mistaken, Planned Parenthood was first established for eugenicist purposes, right? If I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. There's, I mean, there is a long history there, you know, a very shameful history of
yeah, there's nuance there.
Yeah. There's a lot to it, that I am surely not qualified to, you know, even address, to be perfectly honest, just out of ignorance, honestly. Yeah. I don't know enough about that. I mean, yeah, it's there. That history is there.
Yeah. I'll just add something short to this conversation, which is that a point I like to drive home to people is that the conquest never ended, right? When people like to think like, oh yeah, you know, or this is a thing of the past. No, it's not. It's ongoing, right? And if you are the kind of person or the kind of leftist that looks at the conquest as, wow, if I was only there and I was able to fight it, well, you're here now. Let's fight it now.
What are you doing?
Let's actually... Exactly. Let's treat Latin American countries with nuance. Let's treat indigenous movements with nuance. Let's look at them like, okay, I think, in fact, I'm going to shout out the homie Tom Wojcik right now. He put out a great tweet today saying something like, quoting people who say there is no left in this country. No. There is a left. You. So let's get working, right? Let's start working to build that left.
You bring up a very good point, and something I keep trying to, you know, get people to understand that settler colonialism is a process that hasn't ended. You know, it's a continuation thing, just like when we have a revolution, like just like the Cuban Revolution. The Cuban Revolution has never ended. They're still in the process of revolution to create the society that they want. Same thing with settler colonialism. Like the people in power, the people who are the stewards of that power within settler colonialism, it has never ended. It's ongoing. It's a process until the culmination of the society that they want to build. So this shit's still happening. Like you say, the conquest hasn't ended. It's still ongoing. All right. Anyway, moving on. We're going to move on now. In Honduras, this is funny. U.S. Democrat senators led by Jeff Merkley of Oregon have introduced a bill to impose sanctions on Honduran golpista President Juan Orlando Hernandez for allegedly taking bribes from drug traffickers for all the crimes his regime has committed since his 2009 coup. And it also recognizes the U.S.'s complicity in the coup. Would you look at that? Would you fucking look at that? Interesting.
So obviously I've got a lot of love and a lot of time for Honduras, right? So I think one of the most important things to think about this, because I've been following this particular legislation, this particular story for a while now, a lot of it is inspired by the assassination of Berta Cáceres, right? Which the anniversary of that assassination was, God, what was it, just earlier this week, right? And the trial is still ongoing, and that's a whole thing in and of itself. But Berta Cáceres was an incredibly influential and important environmentalist indigenous organizer in Honduras, right? And she was an outspoken member of the left as well, was a supporter of Manuel Zelaya, you know? So I think that's a crucial piece of why people in the United States, or why senators in the United States are actually paying attention to Honduras and actually admitting their role in this, because of how much of an influential and inspiring figure Berta Cáceres was. So I think that's an important thing to point out as well. And if you want to know my personal opinion on this, I say good, fuck Juan Orlando Hernandez, right? He's literally a narco dictator, literally a narco trafficker. I mean, that's just a fact, right? His brother, Tony Hernandez, was literally indicted in U.S. court for trafficking drugs. So that's, you know, just a mind-blowing situation in itself. And here's the fact of the matter. Honduras is going to continue to decay as a society as long as Juan Orlando Hernandez is in power, right? Honduras is going to continue having constant migrant caravans come out as long as a narco dictator is in power. So it's good to see the U.S. acknowledging its complicity in the coup, but obviously there's still a lot of work to be done when it comes to Central America, and especially when it comes to the U.S. government acknowledging its crimes in Central America, right? Because it's the body count that the United States has is in Central America is, of course, one of its highest.
100%. And Juan Orlando Hernandez is what they want to tell us Nicolas Maduro is. So he's actually that guy. Anyway.
Yeah. Right.
Sorry, I have to say, that's such a crucial point, right? How many times do people say, like I love that bullshit conspiracy, what, oh, Nicolas Maduro, he's in the pocket of the cartel of the suns. Okay, guys, they're literally just making shit up. Meanwhile, Ivan Duque in Colombia and Juan Orlando Hernandez in Honduras, who are two of their most, most important, you know, strategic allies for the United States, are literally crucial cogs in the drug trafficking machine. So that's, it would be funny if it wasn't so damn sad.
Exactly. Speaking of Colombia, last headline. Now, the Attorney General is going to move to end the case against former President Uribe. If you remember back to previous episodes that we did, Uribe was on house arrest for bribing and tampering witnesses and procedural fraud while he was a senator. In August, he resigned his seat so that his case would transfer to the Attorney General, who is a close friend of current President Iván Duque, who is essentially an Uribe.
Funny that.
So naturally, look, there's no investigation here because remember, the government did its entire investigation into Uribe. The Attorney General took control of it. Goes, well, we're going to start our own one. We haven't found anything. This is essentially that Spider-Man meme, like when they're like pointing at each other. So that is the current state of fucking Colombia, man. I don't know if you guys had anything to add to that, but it's just typical. Of course, Austin, you have something to add to this.
Oh, I was about to say, come on, buddy. Well, first, the thing that goes without saying is that Alvaro Uribe is maybe the most odious motherfucker in all of Latin American politics, right? And no, I'm including that's people like Bolsonaro something. In that. Alvaro Uribe is a fucking death squad. Alvaro Uribe is a fucking death squad leader. Let's be completely honest here. Alvaro Uribe, like, we could do a whole episode. We could do a series of episodes on how awful Alvaro Uribe is. In fact, there's a great YouTube miniseries. Granted, it's in Spanish, but you can get English subtitles. That was very popular in Colombia about Uribe and how much of a motherfucker he is. He's just a foul motherfucker. This is, God, I can't wait for the day that he is in jail. It is a day that I pray comes, because he definitely could use it. And yeah, like Leroy said, yeah, we're abolitionists. We don't believe in jails, but fuck Alvaro Uribe.
So, you know, I tell you what, like, I am fully confident that the government investigating itself is going to, you know, have a good and just result.
Yeah.
Just like every time a U.S. police department investigates itself, like, there's always justice, you know? So I'm looking forward to the Colombian people, you know, getting the, seeing the malefactor, seeing a monster like Uribe, get the consequences he deserves. You know, surely this will happen, right?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, you got it, T, bro. You got it. That's how it works. Anyway.
I'm smart.
Those are the headlines. You're just smart. Yep, got your finger on the pulse, bro. Understand. those are the headlines. What are we actually going to be talking about? Because I feel like every episode, like, we analyze the headlines more and more, and that sort of is creeping up to be the actual show. But anyway, what are we actually talking about today? A couple of things. We're going to be recapping our interview that we did with Blanca, because there's a lot of things, a lot of takeaways. We'll probably talk about how we related to her story, because, you know, being, you know, Puerto Rican, there's certain similarities there. Being othered in a white society is something we can most definitely relate to, and just El Salvador in general. Also, protests have broken out in Paraguay. You know, we love a good Paraguay story because they don't happen too often. But this was pretty big, pretty huge, and it's moving really, really fast. So I think we should get ahead of it and discuss it a little bit. Has to do with coronavirus, the COVID response of the government, or I'd say the lack of COVID response by the government. If we have time towards the end, I'll do a little bit of homage to Comandante Hugo Chavez, because I believe it was yesterday or the day before, depending on what time zone you're in, was the anniversary of his death. But we'll start off with Chile. So a early poll came out that shows Daniel Jadue, who is the runner, who's the person who's running for the Communist Party of Chile for the presidential election, is actually leading the polls. Communist Party in Chile is leading the presidential polls in a presidential election. This was unfathomable 15 years ago, 20 years ago. It's an early poll, but I think it is vital that we discuss this and break this down, because this is massive. We're talking about Chile, a society that for years banned political parties, banned political thought, that so much like that had the smallest inkling of class analysis, like in their constitution that's going to be, you know, voted on next month, actually, stipulated that, yeah, we have freedom of, you know, of expression, you know, political parties, but the political parties cannot be based on class analysis or class conflict or whatever. And now you have a communist party leading the charge in the presidential elections. That is fucking huge. What are we thinking about this, boys?
Yeah, so I have a lot of thoughts about all of this, obviously. I think the first is that, like you said, Leroy, it's early, right? It's an early poll. The presidential election isn't until November. Still exciting nonetheless, but it's important to point out that there are still a couple dominoes that need to fall first, right? Before we can really analyze what the chances are going to be for Hadwe and the Communist Party. The first really big domino being what you just referenced, the election to decide the Constituent Assembly delegates, or the Constitutional Assembly delegates, which is next month. I believe it's April 11th, if I'm not mistaken. That's going to be a massive election, right? I know we talked a little bit about Chile late last year with our homie Andrew. Shout out Andrew, right? Good homie. And we talked a little bit about what the feeling was in Chile among Chileans when the initial vote of whether or not they were going to write a new constitution was. And it's just so amazing to me, once again, like you were saying, Leroy, to see Chile getting to this point, right? Chile, Sebastián Piñera, this was the right. I say this phrase all the time because it's true, man. It's true. He was the right wing golden boy. I know, right wing media and everything tries to just kind of like gloss it over now, like, let's not talk about this. No, motherfucker. You guys were propping him up like the big shining example for like his entire president. I mean, they've been propping up Chile as the shining example for like 30 years, right? And now, silence, right? Whenever, like, how many? Oh, I'm literally going to start saying, you want to see how effective capitalism is? Look at Chile, motherfuckers. Look at their complete disintegration of society, right? Whoever frames things like that, right?
No, 100%.
It's only when leftist governments or leftist movements are under attack, you know, from sabotage, I would say, that people develop these big grand narratives of, oh my goodness, you see, the left is finally getting beaten back. Look at where Chile is right now. Look at where Peru is right now. Look at where Colombia is right now. The three big right-wing nations of South America, right? Those right-wing regimes are all in peril right now in ways that I certainly have not seen in a very long time. So I'm cautiously optimistic, right, when I look at those polls, right? I think the Communist Party has very effectively woven itself into the big protest movement, and I think that's a big reason for why you're seeing Hadwe poll this well. But I wonder how the Communist Party can, now that this poll has come out, right? I wonder how the Communist Party can withstand an inevitable 6-month smear campaign, right? For a poll, like, look at Bernie. Bernie was pulling, and I know I hate to like make an example of U.S. politics, right? But look at Bernie when he smashed in Nevada, right? That's when the establishment said, okay, we need to all move together and destroy this, right? So we'll see how the Chilean establishment reacts to this.
Yeah. A few things there. You're 100% right with everything. And I'm glad you brought up the term like breakdown in society. I read a book a couple of months ago called Pinochet and Me by Mark Cooper. So Mark Cooper was Allende's English translator back when he was president. So he was there way back. He was a young guy. He was like 20, 21 at the time. And he was there when the coup was happening, when society started to break down. And he said that it was society breaking down. He basically delineates his every so often him returned to Chile to see how everything's going. He was okay because he was American and he was white. He looked gringo, so he was good. But every time he went back, he said everything got worse and worse and worse and worse. He went back like 2 or 3 years after the coup. Shit was breaking down. When the mid-80s, when like protests started coming up, like anti-Pinochet protests were springing up, he said that was a positive move because obviously people weren't afraid of the repression anymore, even though it was still happening. And then the book finished off with him going back early 2000s and basically how the entire economic system has broken down, that if you're rich, you're fine. They've built all this real estate, but it's all like multi-million dollar like condos. The entire pension system has been privatized. The entire healthcare system has been privatized. That basically people work to be able to invest in some semblance of private shares in like the retirement fund or something. Like it's beyond ridiculous, beyond what like the United States is. So if you want to see neoliberalism, you want to see capitalism, you know, quote, working, that's a very good example. And then going back to what I said about like, oh, this is something about a communist party leading up or whatever, we could say, oh, well, Bachelet was part of the Socialist Party and she was president. Ricardo Lago, I think was his name, was elected in 99. He was part of the Socialist Party. Those socialist parties wasn't Allende's Socialist Party. You know what I mean? I think I'm pretty sure Lago had to govern in coalition with a minor right-wing party to make that happen. Same thing with Bachelet. Like, at this point, the Socialist Party of Chile is essentially just a center-left sort of milquetoast type of thing, sort of a European-style, like, Labor Party type of thing. This isn't a communist party or a true Marxist working-class party, right? And I think, Austin, like what you said, like, it's going to be vitally important to see how, like you say, the establishment comes out, whether they take this, whether the left-wing parties sort of take this energy, obviously sabotage the Communist Party to rule outright, but turn around and try to, you know, make concessions to that left-wing movement to be able to govern effectively or at least take power effectively. But again, like you say, it's early, so I guess we'll see.
Something real quick about like this idea that like just because someone has the, you know, is a member of a socialist party, it makes a bit of difference. Let's not forget Lenin Moreno. Let's not forget over in Europe, Silvio Berlusconi in Italy started out as a member of the Socialist Party. Mussolini in Italy started out as a member of the Socialist Party.
Yo, we're going way back, way like, back.
I'm just saying this is not unheard of. But I kind of want to dwell a minute on Pinochet again, right? So like something that people refuse to understand in the United States, especially is neoliberalism, right? So yeah. People think that they'll go with a very vulgar understanding of neoliberalism. Matter of fact, they actually accept the neoliberals' propaganda about themselves as if it's legit. So they'll say, oh, neoliberalism is about, you know, shrinking the government. So it's about shrinking the state. So obviously the solution to neoliberalism is when the government does things. That's a socialism. No, my friends. Neoliberalism did not mean the weakening of the state. In many circumstances and in many cases, neoliberalism meant the increasing power of the state. And Chile is a great example of that. Pinochet is a perfect example of the common ground between neoliberalism, libertarianism, and fascism. The fact of the matter is they're all words describing similar phenomenon, in my opinion, right? And 100%. Pinochet is a great example of that. He had the sort of kind of that old world, like clerico-fascist style of a Franco. He pursued the economic policies of a Thatcher with the police brutality of the United States, of a Reagan, you know? That is neoliberalism. Neoliberalism means withdrawing the state away in terms of social benefits in favor of increasing like police power, right? So now we're also seeing, interestingly enough, let's fast forward to now, you know, you got Chile. We're seeing again in Chile that what works, right? What works and what has demonstrated to work in other Latin American countries, which is powerful social movements, a militant labor movement, and a socialist or communist party that isn't like a bunch of bullshit. You have those elements. Maybe they work in that frenemy thing that we like to talk about, that frenemy theme that exists among socialist parties and social and radical militant movements, you know, and we're seeing that come together in Chile in a really beautiful way. It's really exciting.
Yeah, 100%. And just to follow up on that, that's a very important point to bring up, that this isn't just the Communist Party that all of a sudden got their shit together and they're leading. This comes on the back of like going on like 2-3 years of constant everyday agitation in the streets, combating, you know, right against the carabineros who are blinding motherfuckers. We talked a few weeks ago about like the calls to sort of decertify them and do away with them. This is about people coming together, actually real democracy, people coming together towards the social movements, demanding change and making it happen. And now we're seeing it in the voter box, right? Like we talk about all the time, like this is a kitchen sink approach, that we have people in the streets agitating, and we'll see the results of that. Yeah.
I mean, shit. The Chilean people in the last couple of years have nearly overthrown the government without even the need of the ballot box a couple of times now. They've gotten close.
100%. And exactly. And Piñera is effectively right now totally like inept. Like he has no power in the country. It's the people running. He's
paralyzed. I think at
this
broken.
Yeah, he's terrified. I think at this point he understands that he's just a placeholder into the next election. And I want to go back a little bit to the what you're talking about with neoliberalism. The bullshit, the propaganda about the shrinking state with neoliberalism exists because the state shrinks only in that it gives, it privatizes and gives capital the power it needs to do shit. You know what I mean? It's the state strengthening itself as a, you know, and gave basically letting, setting capital free to privatize everything, which is why, oh, you know, they talk about, oh, you know, the private sector is more, you know, capable of doing this stuff. So we're going to give all these contracts to this tech company here, to fucking Elon Musk and blah, 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 to these NGOs and shit that, you know, they'll do whatever. They suck the wealth, they suck the resource out of that, and then you leave a shell of existence behind, of destruction. Like we talk about like Appalachia. That's exactly what's fucking happened with the coal miners and all that fucking bullshit. So it shrinks because it outsources everything to private capital. But the state exists,
right? You
know, regardless if anything gets bigger. Austin, I think you got something to say, bro?
Yeah, all I was going to say was that before we move on from this story, you know, I think it's really important for everybody listening to be paying attention to Chile, right? This is a story that is, we're going to be talking about this a lot throughout the whole year, right? The Constitutional Assembly delegate election, like we mentioned, is next month. We're definitely going to be talking about it then. And the presidential election in November, right? This is going to be a story that's going to be developing. I think when I think about the quote-unquote resurgence of the left in Latin America, if people want to phrase it like that, I look at Chile as such a huge part of that, right? For obvious reasons, for the reasons that we've just described,
yeah.
Right?
Oh,
for
yeah.
Chile, for Chile, what do assholes here in the United States wear, right? Pinochet did nothing wrong, right? This is a big symbol for them, right? For the left to take back Chile, for the communists to take back Chile, the amount of ass showing that we'll be able to do, it'll be sweet. It'll be so sweet. But once again, we don't do preemptive ass showing though. We'll see how the process develops, and I don't know. I think right now Chile is at a point where it's almost at the point of no return, right? At least when it comes to the Constitution.
That's what it feels like.
The true test is, can the left come together in November, right? The Frente Amplio, the broad front, can they come together in November? That's my question.
Yeah. And yeah, honestly, it's one thing for like a party calling itself the Socialist Party or associated with like Chavista movements like the Union for Hope in Ecuador. Yeah, it's one thing for those parties to be doing shit. It's another thing entirely for a communist party to do things, because that activates all kinds of like wild ass Cold War thinking in the imperial states. So, I mean, this could be some real shit.
Yeah. Real quick before we move on, that's vitally important that you brought that up, because remember at the end of the Pinochet, when he died, you know, left power, whatever, everyone in his cabinet, everyone that was around him are still walking around free for the most part in Chile. Like those motherfuckers are still there. You know what I mean? So the fact that you have a communist party coexisting with Pinochet era, like dignitaries, whatever the fuck we were, or officials, it's pretty huge. Also quickly, because we talked about the Communist Party, but we haven't really talked about Daniel Howe the Way. Just quickly on him, he was a mayor of a smallish town. He's an architect and sociologist, really, really big on communal housing and housing for the poor and designing, you know, those spaces for low-income people. As mayor, he started a bunch of like people-powered like markets and education, all this stuff, really revitalized the communities that he served. And he's of full Palestinian descent as well. So we might have a Palestinian communist president in Chile. So more power in Chile than he has back in the homeland, which is fucking shit, something.
Which really brief side note about that, since we're going to move on from the story now. Just like we touched upon a little bit during our episode with Blanca on Tuesday about the prevalence of the Palestinian diaspora in Central America. If I'm not mistaken, Chile is actually the country in Latin America that has the largest Palestinian diaspora. So there's always been a strong cultural influence of Palestinians in Chile. My favorite Chilean soccer team, Palestino, right? They are named that for a reason. So anyways.
Incredible. You have a favorite Chilean soccer team. Of course you do. Anyway, all eyes on Chile because this is huge. But let's move on to Paraguay, where Protesters have clashed with police in Paraguay's capital as anger over the government's handling of the coronavirus crisis boiled onto the streets and forced the resignation of the country's top health official. So basically, long story short, what happened was people were jumping the queue, so to speak, in terms of who was getting the coronavirus vaccine. People didn't like that. People took to the streets demanding, like, what the fuck? Like, we need this shit. So they took to the streets. They were clashing with security forces in the streets. And they were in the streets basically calling for heads, right? For heads to roll. They were still asking for the president, Mario Abdo, who's another odious right-wing motherfucker, president of Paraguay, to resign. So instead of resigning, what does he do? He demands that his entire cabinet resign because, you know, to be accountable, he's firing everybody else. You know what I mean? I think there's not a lot on this story, just bits and pieces are coming out, but it's coming out very quickly. I think the important thing about this story is how it fits into what's going on in the region as a whole. So this is just another health minister resigning amid coronavirus vaccine controversy, right? So last month, the health minister of Peru, she resigned because when it came to light that former president Vizcarra, so the same president that was congressionally couped back in November, actually received the vaccine along with his wife in October. When that came to light, she resigned. In Argentina as well, the other day, the health minister resigned, was asked to resign by President Fernandez. Similar thing. Journalists and certain, you know, friendly people were magically vaccinated after having private meetings with the health minister. Fernandez asked him to resign because that's unacceptable. He did, cordially, you could say. But yeah, so this comes within the context of this happening over and over again. And let's not forget as well, Bolsonaro in Brazil, the other day, I think even just yesterday, they passed 260,000 COVID deaths. And what was Bolsonaro's response? To tell his people to stop fucking whining. His literal words were, stop whining.
Yo, so before we get deep into Bolsonaro and the effects of COVID throughout the region, because that's definitely a big part of the story, I think it's, you know, God, like you said, Leroy, sometimes it's tough to find things on Paraguay, not because things aren't happening in Paraguay, but because Paraguay, you know, it's such an interesting country, right? It's relatively isolated in the region. It's got its own deeply unique culture, and which is why it's been sad, right, to see what has happened to Paraguay after the infamous parliamentary coup against Fernando Lugo. What was that, in 2012, right? That was the return of the Colorado Party, right? Which is essentially, yeah, which is like the infamous right wing party of Alfredo Stroessner, right? Who was like one of the most, who was some might say the worst right wing dictator of the 20th century in Latin America.
He was the blueprint. He was the blueprint for those parliamentary coups in South America, pretty much. Yep. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Like,
and yeah, and he ruled with the Colorado Party for over 30 years as just a dictator, right? Once again, as just a, yeah, and this is Alfredo Stroessner, right? This is a German dictator in a majority indigenous nation, right? A story we've heard so many times before in Latin America. Very sad. But yeah, the Colorado, this was after the parliamentary coup against Fernando Lugo. This was the return of the Colorado Party, which Mario Abdo, of course, is a representative of. And once again, it's just been very sad to kind of see that development because Paraguay was once part of the pink tide, right? Paraguay was considered, yep, a country that, yeah, was part of the pink tide.
Yeah.
And I think people kind of forget that sometimes. I also think that when I think about this story, the images from the protests have been incredible, right? The size of the protests, like this is some serious shit, right? Like Mario Abdo can sack his cabinet. This shit ain't going away. Right. This shit is not going to go away as long as you were saying, Leroy, as long as countries in the region continue to botch the response. Right. And first and foremost, when it comes to botched responses in South America, Brazil is going to continue to be a vector for this shit as long as Bolsonaro is in power. Right. It's going to make it almost impossible for South America to properly combat the coronavirus and properly get vaccinations to people as long as, you know, Bolsonaro is in power in Brazil. But as we have discussed before, maybe Bolsonaro won't be in power in Brazil for much longer. But I don't know. Maybe that's wishful thinking. I don't know.
Just very quickly, I'm literally reading up on Abdo a little bit. And I just read that you brought up Stroessner. Apparently, Abdo, the current president of Paraguay, his father was Stroessner's private secretary.
Oh my
God.
Private secretary.
It's
When Stroessner died in 2006, Abdu Benitez was the president, was one of the pallbearers at his funeral in Brasilia. Everything about that sentence is just odious. The fact that this right-wing dictator was buried or at least had his funeral in fucking Brazil and that the current president was a pallbearer. Like, you can't write this shit. Like, you can't make this shit up.
What? It's always like this. Why is it always like this? Oh my God.
Yeah. So when people talk about like, oh, free and open elections and shit, this was never, he was always going to be president. You know what I mean? Like, Mario Abdo was always going to be president.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, it was just a natural, it was almost like inheriting the throne, essentially.
Yeah, I'm glad that you bring that up, Leroy, and I'm glad that, you know, I didn't know that. That's very fascinating. But it's just another example of, like, the brazenness of the right wing in Latin America, right? It's just no shame. Don't give a fuck whatsoever. Like, we were talking about Juan Orlando Hernandez earlier. Yeah, my brother's a drug trafficker. I don't give a fuck, right? Just the brazenness. You were talking about Colombia earlier, too, the brazenness. Like, it's just amazing, right? The shamelessness, like, the shamelessness of Peruvians that will continue to uphold the legacy of Fujimori, right? Just the shamelessness in people that will, you know, deny any, like, death squad massacres in Central America, you know? It's incredible. So I'm not even remotely surprised that Mario Abdo has direct relations to the Stroessner dictatorship. But it is, of course, very, very disheartening. But I'm encouraged by the protests, man. I really am. Good for the Paraguayan people, dude. This is a story to follow. This is not a story that's going away. You motherfucker Abdo, you can sack your cat. Once again, like I said, you can sack your cabinet. That ain't going to give vaccines to people, right? Unless you actually fix the problem, you're going to continue to feel the pressure.
Yeah, this is a classic. This is one of our classic problems for our show, where we talk about a story, and probably the day we release the episode, it's going to be like fucking like 1,000 things have already progressed. Probably in the middle of this conversation, shit's already moving, right? Like, what's crazy too is that this is part and parcel, and I think it's important too. This uprising in Paraguay is part and parcel of the global protests and uprisings that have been going on for the last couple of years. I think this movement is international, and this resistance to these to global capital and to, you know, nation states, it's global.
Yo, I'm so glad you mentioned that point, as far as things getting dated. Like, oh my goodness, like, each time we've done a story like Ecuador, Haiti, literally El Salvador on Tuesday, right? Like, the narratives can literally completely flip like within a day. But so once again, that's why driving the point home, this is a story to watch because this is a developing story.
You heard it here, folks. Machete Mate, finger on the pulse. Ahead of the game. We're ahead of the game here. No, but literally, like, just on this Paraguay story, like, I think Austin, like, in our chat, like, you're like, oh, look, things are happening in Paraguay. Oh shit, cool. An hour later, oh shit, this happened earlier today. Oh shit, he's about to fire his entire thing. But like you said, by the time we're finished with the show, like, there could be like an invasion from fucking like the Argentina or something. You know what I mean? Like,
the new People's Army could take Asuncion.
Yeah, hopefully. That'd be dope. Anyways, like Austin was saying, this is definitely a story to watch, especially with like a place like Paraguay, because again, we don't hear anything from Paraguay. Like Austin says, not because shit doesn't happen there. Of course shit happens there, but for whatever reason, no one talks about it. It's some like small, obscure country in the middle of nowhere that no one cares about, but we definitely care about. And this is a huge thing that the people are actually rising up against the legacy of fucking US-backed fascism in the region. You know what I mean?
Sorry, really quick before we move on for this, I just have to say, you know, I got a lot of time for Paraguay. This is the only place that where Guarani, an indigenous language, is literally just spoken hand in hand with Spanish, right? Yeah. Like, it's just basically a lingua franca. And Guarani is such an interesting language, and the history of it is so interesting. There's a reason for that, right? There's a reason that it's widely spoken in Paraguay. But Paraguay is just such a deeply fascinating country. So I got a lot of time and love for Paraguay. We all do.
Yeah, 100%. That's a perfect point. Just on that point, like, you know how we speak Spanglish? Well, a lot of the population speaks Guaranilish or whatever, like a mix of like
Guaranol.
Code switch between Guarani, Guaranol, yeah, that stuff. I'm really, really, really fascinating linguistically. But anyway, again, all eyes on Paraguay. We'll definitely revisit this as it speeds up and hopefully culminates in something good. Anyway, let's move on to sort of a debrief of our conversation with Blanca. Like, again, if you haven't listened to it, it was truly amazing. I know, even though, like, as Puerto Ricans, like, a lot of some of the details are going to be different, like how we arrived in the United States, how our people got here, whatever, is going to be very different. But a lot of the things that she talked about, like a lot of the things that about assimilating, about being in like two space or whatever, it's something that we've talked about here ad nauseum, and how we grew up and the things that we could relate to or couldn't relate to because of our identity and stuff. And just quickly on that point, I know Austin, you said during that, you said that you appreciated me or whatever because you came in kind of self-conscious about your Puerto Ricanness, and I came like, oh no, look, you're Puerto Rican, whatever, whatever. For me, like, when it comes to identity, when it comes to quote Puerto Ricanness in this example, like, I'm not about that like blood quantum, like fucking 23andMe bullshit. Like, if you feel Puerto Rican, if you organize in community, if you try to, if you're attached to your culture, at least if you have no idea, you're trying to, you know, get some sort of semblance of attachment to it and you're working towards that, bro, you're Puerto Rican. I don't care if you have one distant grandmother. If you acknowledge that and you're in a community, if you're trying to move forward the struggle, get to understand who you are within that context, that's all that's necessary. You know what I mean? It's not like these, you know, people who take those DNA tests who find, oh, I'm 5% Cherokee. And they like live on that without any association, any connection to community. That's fucking bullshit. Yeah.
Exactly. So I should be extraordinarily clear as well. You know, that's the exact opposite of my experience, right? As far as like, oh, I saw a DNA test. Oh my goodness. Now, oh, I need to embrace my Puerto Rican heritage or whatever. I always identified as Puerto Rican, right? My brother and I, we've always identified as Puerto Rican our entire lives, right? It's just the way we, let me say, the way we emphasize that identity, I guess, evolved over time, right? Whether that was an emphasis on, as I mentioned during the episode, the emphasis on like, oh, well, you know, we're assimilating Puerto Ricans, right? We're Puerto Ricans that have assimilated into U.S. society, right? Or
we're the,
you know,
good ones.
Exactly, we're the good ones, right? Which I think that was a phrase that Blanca literally used on Tuesday. And that's something, there was actually an anecdote that I won't get too deep into. But as T mentioned during our conversation with Blanca, you know, having something to the effect of, I have experienced those exact same situations, right? I can think in my head, like scene for scene, the things that you were describing. And that, being told that you are one of the good ones. Oh, I've had that happen to me plenty of times.
Right? Oh, God,
I've had plenty of times where I've had, you know, Southern white people say things to me like that. And it's certainly an awkward conversation. Which is why, once again, to me, one of my biggest takeaways from that, it's amazing to me how similar all of us are, and it's extremely rewarding to me to be able to do this podcast, right, to bring these different voices, to give a platform to amazing people like Blanca Estevez and Matt Tapia, which we have done previously as well, these amazing Hispanic organizers that are doing amazing work, that deserve to have a platform, that deserve to be connecting with each other, so that once again, we can all be reminded that we are not alone and that we are all in this together.
Yes.
I'm gonna tell you what, it is stunning what white Southerners will tell you when they think you're cool. I'm telling you, it would take your breath away, straight up. Just that's a little point. I was really grateful for talking with Blanca because it's we come from so many different places, you know, our ancestors come from so many different places, and it's really just, it's remarkable to see that despite that, you know, that diversity of our origins, so many of our experiences can be so similar, especially if you end up like a working class, you know, immigrant, or you know, there was a whole thing, especially among Puerto Ricans who came to the United States, like in the 50s and 60s, which is around the era that a lot of Austin and I's family first came over, the ones that came to the U.S. That was a real thing where they would not teach Spanish to their kids, where they, you know, where they would insist on, you know, very Anglo names, where they insisted on trying to, you know, assimilate, because that was the culture. It was like, no, we're not Puerto Rican anymore. We're Americans.
Yeah, all the time people would ask me growing up, you know, why I can't speak Spanish. And aside from the fact that our parents are deaf, which that's literally the number one reason why we don't speak Spanish, I'd say the number two reason is when I went to visit Abuela, I was just driving up to Pennsylvania, right? Because our entire family had already been displaced, right? Completely and totally displaced from the island. So our connections to the island were always we were so far away from that growing up because of once again, the displacement that our family had already experienced. You know, I don't want to get too deep into our family history, but they were, I mentioned a little bit how our abuelo was born in Jayuya, right? Our family, they were coffee growers in that region, right? On the border between Jayuya and Ponce. And they literally had, all that shit. And that was literally the shit that our dad was raised with. But
yeah, legitimately.
Here's the thing. It's funny how many Puerto Ricans claim Jíbaro, right? No, our dad is literally a Jíbaro. Like, literally. Like, if you met him and heard his story, you'd be like, holy shit, this guy's like fucking mountain as fuck. Like, I grew up thinking about my relation to Puerto Rico as, oh yeah, my family's from the mountains, not really knowing what that truly meant culturally until I got older, right? Not really knowing what it meant to have family from rural Ponce and Jayuya until I got older. I wish I had more connections to that, right? But once again, our family's
And you know, slowly over, you know, the last, like, you know, 20 years, we have, you know, started, you know, we did start to make those connections. Like, we started to find ourselves when we started to reconnect with our relatives and shit like that over the last 20 years. And it has been an incredible, really enriching thing for me, and I'm sure Austin as well.
Just quickly, for those who are listening who are not familiar with what Jíbaro means, Jíbaro is just a term for, like, our mountain country folk. So I guess our classic peasants on the island, you know what I mean? So anytime we sing any, like, folkloric songs or poems, whatever, it's about the struggle and the nobility, the nobleness, the dignity of the, you know, the mighty Jíbaro toiling on the land and stuff like that. So these two motherfuckers, like, their ancestors are actually Jíbaros. Mine are more on the coast in Aguadilla on my mom's side. On my dad's side, they're Afro-Puerto Rican, so that's all slaves. Anyway, sorry, Austin, go ahead.
No, yeah. That's amazing. That's amazing to know that, Leroy, and I did know that about your family. But yeah, our family is quite literally Jíbaros. It's quite remarkable. But, you know, I go back to something you were just saying to you, right, about how important it has been in the past couple of years rediscovering our identity. And I'll just echo something that Blanca said on the episode on Tuesday, which is, like, in many ways, the past 2 years have been the greatest 2 years of my entire life, right? And the biggest reason that is the case is because of the way that I've been able to rediscover, reconnect with my identity in ways that I never have. Like, my brother can speak to how many identity crises I had growing up, right? Constantly wondering, like, God, what box do we fit in, right? We're not Northern, we're not Southern, we're not Puerto Rican, we're not in the United States, we're not this, we're not that, right? To finally find a community, right? To finally connect with people, you know, Puerto Ricans in the DC community, shout out Boricos Unidos, right? Really good folks. You, Leroy, this podcast, Boris Hawk, shout out all the Boris Hawk homies. It's been a truly rewarding experience, and one that I can never stop thanking you for, Leroy, right? Thank you, as I thanked you on the podcast. I put you over big time, and so you're welcome.
Thank you, man. Thank you. But with that said, like, I've talked about it as well, my experience growing up has been really, really different. I had a strong connection to the island. I grew up in a massive Puerto Rican community, but a lot of the things are the same. Because for me, I grew up, both of my parents are Puerto Rican. Everyone in my family is Puerto Rican. I went to my high school was like 65% Puerto Rican. But it was
amazing.
That still presents challenges, because you grow up being Puerto Rican, seeing this image of what it is to be Puerto Rican, but also living not in Puerto Rico, you know what I mean? Like, and the thing is, like, what would happen is, obviously, people of my age, people who grew up in Florida, our parents came over 70s, 80s, early 90s. So they had a very particular image of what Puerto Rico is and what Puerto Rican culture is. And then slowly we got newer generations of Puerto Rico. So Puerto Rican culture will keep evolving. So Puerto Rican culture will keep going. So now you have this new stock of Puerto Ricans coming in who are presenting their Puerto Ricanness in a different way, when what we knew, the slang we use, is from like 25 years ago. You know what I mean? So it's navigating that as well, while also trying to show white people that, you know, we are the good ones, whatever the fuck that means. You know what I mean?
I think you kind of touch on something that's really important too, which is that identity has both good and bad to it. Okay. So not only is it important, you know, can it, like, kind of give you rewarding experiences, connection to people, connection to tradition, to your culture. Sometimes that shit is stifling. There are things in cultures that are not good, all right, that have to be overcome, right? Identity for, you know, where some people see freedom in discovering their identity, some people see chains. Some people see something that they want to break free or redefine, more importantly, you know? So I think it's important to acknowledge, too, that identity being complex is not 100% like, oh, you know, it's all 100% great. You know, this kind of like, we don't want to be misty-eyed about things, you know? Sometimes that, you know, some people see these as things to transcend in some respects. And I think that's important to think about as well.
Yeah, and that's 100% true. And just going back to Blanca, who was the subject of the show, how much did it break your heart when she was talking about her abuelita? Because like, every time she brought up abuelita, I was like, oh, man, because I'm pretty close to my abuela, and she obviously is back in Puerto Rico, and I'm all over here. So, and it's hard because obviously she's older. She can't navigate, like, Facebook Messenger as well. So she'll just send me random, like, Jesus sparkly gifs and shit. But that was really tough.
Yeah, you see, Blanca and I talk about our abuelitas all the time. So for me, that was just Tuesday. But what I will say to slightly shift gears here a little bit, I think it's also important when I think back to that conversation to do a little bit of a further digesting of the legislative results in El Salvador, right? Especially since we are kind of coming on an hour here already. So update, right? Basically, we were right and the polls were right, right? It does look like.
Yay.
Winning a super majority. I don't know that it's official yet, but it's basically official. This means he can appoint Supreme Court judges. This means he can basically do whatever the fuck he wants. This means El Salvador is going to turn into Bukele's playhouse. But most importantly, like I said on Tuesday, this means Bukele now has to govern, right? This odious fuck, you know what he's already been talking all week, talking bullshit all week. Even today, talking about voter fraud and oh my God, it's all these other fucks, right? Even though his party won, right? And he's still out here whining, complaining to try and absolve him of any sort of responsibility to govern, as you're alluding to, Leroy, right? Can he just hide from governing? I would say no, he cannot hide from governing. I truly firmly believe that if he spends 4 years saying, I don't give a fuck about Salvadoran migrants, his popularity is going to go into the shitter. Because as long as he is signing neoliberal trade deals that fuck over Salvadoran migrants, he is going to fuck himself. Now, don't get me wrong. I am not saying the chickens are going to come home. Like I said, my prediction, set in stone, Fujimori, right? Yeah, sure. He'll have his lifelong followers. He'll have his assholes that are going to, you know, be behind him until the day he dies. But mark my words, he is going to run away from San Salvador with his tail tucked between his legs with millions of dollars of embezzled funds. That's my prediction.
To Miami, you reckon?
My prediction is Morocco. And the reason I say Morocco is because, interestingly enough, one of the first things Nayib Bukele did when he took office was remove El Salvador's recognition of Western Sahara to get on the good side of the Moroccan government. So that's my dark horse pick.
Okay. Anyways. We're taking bets here.
Yo, let me set this down right now, okay? Every single thing, every single nightmare critique, every rumor that people gave to Maduro, to all left-wing governments, Bukele will do it. Yeah, Zelaya, Bukele will do it. He will do it. He is going to do every horrible thing, every nasty thing that the Western press claims left-wing leaders will do. He'll do it, and he'll get praised for it. Mark my words.
This is like on a more personal note with him. Like, you know what he reminds me of? You know that like kind of rich dickhead kind of popular kid that everyone hangs around because he has nice toys or whatever? Who feels entitled to talk shit because of that?
Totally.
That's Bukele. That's Bukele. Like his dad owns a company or whatever, so he thinks he can talk shit. He thinks he can get girls. And if the girls don't like him, you know, they're fucking, you know, whatever. You know what I mean? Like, He's that guy until, I guess to your point, Austin, until everyone realizes how much of a fucking loser he is. And then he'll have his tail tucked between his legs. That's who that motherfucker is.
Exactly. I quoted Oscar Ortiz, which once again, I know he's slightly problematic, but I quoted Oscar Ortiz, the former vice president of El Salvador on Tuesday, and his quote was something to the effect of, "We've stared down thugs, we've stared down dictators, we're not afraid of you, motherfucker," right? And that's true. The FMLN has literally been through worse. So right now, this is when we need to stay with our comrades. We need to be with our comrades. The FMLN definitely has some internal reshuffling that it needs to engage in. And I think there are good people within the FMLN that are engaging in that work.
On that note, I think one of the most powerful things that Blanca said was to that effect, that the FMLN, like, they're in a spot where, like, they can say, we've been there before. Like, we're not afraid to go back to that. We're trying to almost do you a favor by running in these elections. You know what I mean? And the way she phrased it and, like, the power she said it with, that was immensely powerful, which is true. Like, we want to talk about kitchen sink approach. They were legit in the mountains fighting for their lives, man. Like, back in the 80s, where their comrades, their family members, their children, their wives, their husbands, whatever, were being genocided by U.S.-backed fucking militaries. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And they can easily just go back to that. So we need to stand firm with them as well and understand that we have an entire world to win, and they're part of that bigger struggle. So again, like I said, as Boricuas, as colonized Boricuas, our solidarity with always would be with El Salvador.
Absolutely. Not only does the United States owe a shitload of reparations to the Caribbean, it owes a shitload of reparations to Central America. You damn right. And, you know, that's another conversation entirely.
100%. And just quickly, because Blanca kind of gave a prediction about how, like, he's sort of going to overshoot popularity. What are predictions? You reckon he's going to last the entire 4 years, get reelected, or final predictions, I guess?
So
if we can make a prediction.
So here's one of the most crucial points to point out. He's term limited, right? Technically, he is term limited. The question is, will he? The question is he going to try to abolish term limits? Yes, I think he will. I think he's going to do one of two things. And we kind of touched upon a little bit of this on Tuesday. He's either just going to go full Juan Orlando Hernandez and just abolish term limits, right? Meanwhile, shitting on Maduro. Or, as T was mentioning on Tuesday, he'll go full Putin, you know, have an appointed douche or whatever the fuck govern for 5 years after he does, and then, you know, try and run for president again. I could see something like that happen. But I think if I was a betting man, I'd say he probably moves to abolish term limits sometime in the next year. Oh my God. Because that's what he would need to do if he wanted to run again. So we'll see though.
100%. 100%. T, what do you reckon?
It's hard to say. I agree, Austin, that he is definitely going to abolish term limits or going to make a move for. I think, you know, I'm willing to bet that he's going to be popular, real popular, up until that moment. And then we're going to see politics once again fracture in El Salvador with that issue. Like, I think with this majority in the Congress or in the parliament or whatever, he's going to be confident and they're going to be moving and his enemy, his opponents are going to be disorganized and disoriented. But I think that we're going to see the next chapter of serious resistance to him when he moves to abolish term limits. And I think that's inevitable too.
I agree. And I think going back to something I think you said, T, and we talked about before, is having term limits is almost like irrelevant. Like, if there's a person in power that's effective, who's doing really good shit, whatever, and he's under his power is doing good, who the fuck cares? But we're talking about this odious motherfucker who ostensibly talks about, you know, democracy, the rule of law, and all this fucking bullshit, even though we know that's all bullshit. And we're going to see that contradiction happen. Again, I'm probably the most pessimistic person on here, so I think he's going to abolish term limits, people are going to fight back, he's going to lock everything down, he might self-coup, and the rest is history. The rest is going to be the normal story. But then again, I'm the most pessimistic person on this show. Quickly, Austin.
Well, this is why I use the Fujimori example, right? That motherfucker dissolved Congress and ruled by decree for, like, what, a decade, right? I could see that happen. Yeah. I could see that literally happen. I could see him abolish, like, the worst case scenario. This is the worst case scenario, right? Because I don't want people who are listening to think that I'm trying to be overly optimistic and saying, oh, he's going to flee El Salvador. Don't get me wrong. The Salvadoran left is at a low point right now. I fully recognize that, right? There are dark days ahead for El Salvador, potentially. I recognize that. And to me, that is the potential worst-case scenario, Fujimori scenario, where he's widely popular. He uses that popularity to crack down on leftists and cement his rule. And I think I could see a scenario where he literally just is ruling by decree at some point. I do not rule out him literally ruling by decree at some point within the next 5 years. If you would like me to sprinkle a little bit of cynicism on there.
No, I think that's right. I think, to be honest, again, like you say, if I was a betting man, I think that's the likely scenario. Hopefully I'm wrong, but I don't know. We'll see, I guess. Cool. So do we have time for a Chavez sort of eulogy, homenaje, like we say in Spanish, or should we just put a bow on it?
So I will absolutely have time for a little bit of some eulogizing on El Comandante, right?
That question was to you specifically.
I've always been very clear that I'll try and be quick here. You know, like you said, it was what, the eighth anniversary of his death, right? A day that I truly will never forget. I think T and I took like whiskey shots or some shit like that. Or no,
we did.
Did we drink our Puerto Rico Libres? Was that what we did? I don't remember.
No, yeah, we got hammered. We got really drunk that night. Ooh. I remember that. Well, I don't remember what it was.
Okay. Okay, hold on. Maybe you got hammered because I did not. Because I had to work that day, unfortunately. I'm sure I would have if I could have.
Did you get sickled?
You fucks, you keep interrupting me. I remember taking a shot before I went into work that day, right? It was just, obviously it was sad, right? It was a sad moment. I've always been very clear to people, you know, people often ask, you know, I think when I first joined DSA, the most common question I would get from people is, well, how did you become a socialist? And I remember at the time when people would ask me that, it just seemed like I didn't know how to answer that, right? Because I've been a socialist for like 10 years before I joined DSA, right? It's not like I joined during the Bernie campaign because I just rediscovered socialism. I was like, oh yeah, no, I've considered myself a Marxist and a socialist for a long time. And as I thought about that question more and more, I thought to myself, you know, it really was Chavez, man. It really was Chavez who was a major influence on me when it comes to embracing socialism. I don't think Chavez gets nearly enough credit for embracing the word socialism when everybody else was running away from it, man. In 1998, dude, he was out here saying, no, we need to revive socialism. That's why he talked about socialism of the 21st century, right? This is a socialism that is very dialectical, right? This is a socialism that has evolved from the 20th century, right? And that's important, right? I think it's important to build on both of our successes and our failures, right? And that's why, to this day, I call myself a 21st century socialist. So pour one out for El Comandante.
Yeah, I remember I was day drinking that whole day, man. That was rough. That was fucking rough.
100%. And they got him with the cancer gun as well.
They did.
Oh, anyway. Yes. They absolutely.
Yeah.
I think there's actually, like, I remember reading, maybe it's conspiracy shit, I don't know, but I remember reading somewhere that, like, somebody, like, one of his, like, cooks or something was actually, like, a CIA agent or some shit like that, like our FBI agent. I don't know. I probably shouldn't speculate with things like that, but I'm pretty sure I read that somewhere.
That's some true shit.
I was going to say, don't take my word for it. So anyways, that's a good time to wrap up.
But we all agree that it was the cancer gun, though. That's a fact. We know that, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yes. 100%. 100%.
Yeah, 100%. But in all seriousness, again, like we like to say, Comandante Hugo Chavez, presente, forever, leading the path to the socialist 21st century, will always be remembered in the region as that figure for, you know, whether it's a positive or negative, he's still the revolutionary figure in the region who's revitalizing socialism, Marxism in the region and setting an example for even those of us Puerto Ricans on the left. It's something that we can aspire to and sort of model what our future around, obviously, while applying our own particular contradictions for our struggle. We need to look back at our, you know, our martyrs and our elders that come before us as we plan a path forward. So always rest in peace. Que en paz descanse Hugo Chavez. Love you, buddy. Love you, compadre. Love you, compa. Anyway, we'll put a bow on it. And with that said, thanks for tuning in. Always appreciate the listenership. Again, if you support what we do and want to support what we do and stay in solidarity with us, consider going over to our Patreon and becoming a compa oficial. Not only will you help the cause, not only will you help us do some of the things that we want to do to get off the ground, you'll also gain access to Machete After Dark that we're going to actually be recording right after this. It's a bit more relaxed. It's a little less, you know, newsy, but still have a lot of fun doing that. Still informative. Really silly, though. We have a lot of fun doing that. So definitely check that out. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, everything. Yeah, Austin?
Yeah, also, at the top of the podcast, we plugged my appearance on Meet the Left with Kenzo Shibata, as well as on A Left Reckoning with Matt Letch and David Griscom. I will also be tomorrow night on Midwest Socialist with the homeboy Matt Tapia, so look out for that one. That'll be a really good interview as well, so check it out.
100%. All comrades of the show, all friends of the show. Definitely check them out. But yeah, again, thanks for listening. Again, if you haven't listened to the Blanca interview, we've actually gotten feedback from like just random saying like it was incredible. So definitely check that out. Take their word for it. Because it was really, really, really good. I'm not just saying that. But with that said, see you next time. Thanks for tuning in. Y hasta la victoria.
Peace.
Later, y'all.